Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Our guest today is Dr. Gary Klein, cognitive psychologist, senior scientist at Macro Cognition LLC, and founder of Shadowbox LLC, celebrated for his pioneering work in the field of naturalistic decision-making, NDM, or macrocognition, and for significantly influencing both academic research and practical applications in under-pressure decision-making in real-world environments. Known in the world of science for developing several models of cognitive processes, Dr. Klein is also the creator of multiple methods for training cognitive skills, such as the critical decision method, the pre-mortem method of risk assessment, and the shadow box training method. A PhD in experimental psychology by the University of Pittsburgh in the 1970s, Dr. Klein is a fellow of both the American Psychological Association and the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society, and author of more than 150 publications, including numerous books such as Sources of Power, How People Make Decisions, The Power of Intuition, Working Minds, Streetlights and Shadows, Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Way We Gain Insights, and his latest book, Snapshots of the Mind.
So welcome to our series, Gods, and the second part of our interview with Dr. Gary Klein. Thank you for being here with us today, sir. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Julius Caesar, an excellent military man, was fearless and bold in the battlefield. He nevertheless recognized, and I'm citing him, that no one is so brave that he is not disturbed by something unexpected. Dr. Klein, you helped redesign the Situation Room at the White House to make it easier for the U.S. president to make the right decisions. Through at least 40 years of professional career, you've been analyzing where expertise and insight played a crucial role. And I'm asking you, who have accompanied and observed very brave and experienced men and women, firefighters, soldiers, pilots, people in the line of fire, making decisions under ultimate pressure. How are experts in these conditions able to keep focused, to overcome fear and keep their cool, so to say, when unexpected situations arrive?
I think that they are in a state of, maybe a state of flow. They are so much in the situation that they're not noticing fear. They don't have time to be afraid. If you've been in an automobile accident and you've had to make some emergency movements, you're just making all those movements. And then afterward, the fear comes over you. But at the time, you're just consumed by, what do I have to do at this point? And you're locked into this situation.
Taking a decision in such conditions brings various elements into play. Let's hear now how Thomas van Herlick, Professor Emeritus of Surgery at the Amsterdam University Medical Center in the Netherlands, describes gut feeling, highlighting the fact that experience is an element that cannot be missing.
Yes, gut feeling. What is gut feeling? Well, that appeals to a gastrointestinal surgeon in a special way, I think. Well, I think it is maybe more important than we usually think of. It is the feeling which is based on experience. It is a feeling you get because you've seen so many of these patients and you've treated all of these patients and you know what the outcomes of these patients might be.
Professor van Herlick seems to agree with Julius Caesar, who also said that experience is the teacher of all things, and also with Captain Sully. How could he land a passenger airplane on the Hudson River, saving everybody's on board's life without losing his nerve? That is something that I ask myself on and on. You know, he mentioned in several interviews that I've seen how his colleagues would tell him that traits that they saw in him, such as discipline and being precise, and also his integrity throughout his whole career, seemed to have prepared him and to have come all together to help him act the way he did on that day. And he also mentioned that this building of experience over time helped him maneuver that airplane on that morning in order to land safely and saving the lives of everybody on board. So do you agree with Julius Caesar, Van Hulik and Captain Sully, Dr. Klein, that expertise is the teacher of all things, meaning, of course, also intuition?
I agree up to a point that compiling these experiences is important. But it's not just the time that you've spent and how many years you've spent. It's also how many tough cases you've had to handle. And it's also about failures. Maybe not catastrophic failures, but failures you've seen in yourself and others, because we can learn a great deal from failures as we reflect on them. And so then we have to get feedback on our performance. And then we have to reflect on what did we do and what should we have done. In hindsight, here's how I should have handled that. Because if you can't be smart with hindsight, you can never be smart. And so you need this feedback. But you also need to diagnose the feedback. How reliable is the feedback? What can I glean from the feedback? So yes, experience is essential, but there is all these additional facets of experience that people like Julius Caesar and Napoleon and Sullenberger were able to pick up on. Let's look at Sullenberger, and I've listened to the tape, and his voice is so calm through the whole episode.
It's incredible.
It is incredible. So he takes off. For the listeners who may not be familiar with the case, this was called The Miracle on the Hudson. I think it was 2009. He takes off of LaGuardia Airport in New York City, and he's climbing, and he turns left because he has to go west. And then he hits the flock of geese, and all of a sudden, he doesn't have any engine power whatsoever. So you try to restart the engine, and then he's got a co-pilot to work with, and they work together very effectively. And he immediately contacts air traffic controller, because the first thing you do when you're in that situation is you return to the airport. The air traffic controller is frantically trying to wave all the other airplanes off so Sullenberger can return. But you don't just turn around. You've got to turn left and then turn left again and come around in order to get to the airport. And then he's imagining how much altitude he's going to lose as he makes each of these turns. Now, that's a complicated mental simulation to do. And he did it in maybe 30 seconds, maybe less, as the air traffic controller is trying to get him back to LaGuardia. And he's thinking about how that's going to work. And he just says, I can't make it. And he makes that judgment. Maybe he could have. People have argued about that. But it would have been a tremendous risk, because if he got it wrong, he would have crashed into all kinds of buildings in Manhattan, Queens. So then he says, what else can I do? That's the next option, is to just, he's headed west. I'll go to Teterboro. That's an airport directly ahead of me. But that's about 11 or 12 miles away. And so the air traffic controller is trying to get him vector to Teterboro. And he thinks about it. He does the mental simulation. He says, I can't make it. It's too far away. He's going through his options one after the other until he comes to one that's possibly workable, which is the last one he'd ever want to do, which is to land on the Hudson River in January in all the cold weather. But that was the only option that was left to him.
And he made it.
And he made it, and there was no loss of life.
Yeah, it was a bird strike. Can I get him in for runway one?
Runway one, that's good.
Okay, 1529, turn right 280, you can land runway one at Teterboro.
We can't do it.
Okay, which runway would you like at Teterboro?
We're going to be in the Hudson.
I'm sorry, say again, Cactus.
Yeah, that's an incredible case. Dr. Klein, you created another method that involves a created scenario that allows trainees to see hypothetical situations through the eyes of experts, a method called the shadow box method. Could you delve a little bit about this method and when and where has it proved to be most effectively applied?
Sure. I would love to take credit for the Shadowbox method, but it was really developed by a senior firefighter, Neil Heintz, after the 9/11 attacks in New York, to help firefighters prepare themselves for situations that they hadn't trained on, because you can't train on everything. And the way it works is you put people in a tough situation, a challenging situation. This could be you give it to them in text, they're reading it on screen or a notebook or something, or we often do it online. So you're just following through this. And at certain points, we stop the action. We say, here's a decision point. Here's four options. Rank order the options from the best to the worst. Just rank them and write down your reasons why you rank them that way. Then we continue the scenario, and then we'll stop it again later on. And here's decision point two. Here are three goals that you can try to achieve. Rank order the importance of each one and write down your reasons. And then we continue, and then we stop the action again. And we might ask them a different question. It could be, here's five pieces of information. Rank order how important each of these is and write down why you think it's the most important to the least. Now, we also have had a small set of experts, 3 to 5 experts, go through the exact same scenario. And they've done their ranking and they've written down their reasons and we've compiled their results. So we can provide this to you as feedback. When you do your ranking, we can say, now let's see how the experts rank these options. And you want your ranking to match theirs. So that's sort of like a challenge. That's the game-like aspect of it. But the real learning is when you look at the reasons that the experts wrote down compared to the reasons that you wrote down. And all of a sudden you have an appreciation for what the experts were seeing that you were not. So this is a way of seeing the world through the eyes of experts. But the experts don't have to be there, because once they've gone through the scenario, we're done with them. We compile their results. So this is an efficient way to train that doesn't require the experts to have to be present. And where have we applied it? We've applied it, done it in military environments, in child protective services, in medicine with nurses. We've applied it in a variety of different situations.
This is a fantastic way to take a look at the whys that we were talking about before. And Dr. Klein, you were talking about this concept of flow. And I would like to play a clip. We will hear experts from our Season 2 movement talk about the building of expertise and this concept of flow, a psychological concept used to describe a state of increased focus and immersion in activities such as art, play, and work, first coined by Hungarian psychologist and philosopher Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. We will now hear renowned neurosurgeon Peter Bajkocsi talk about the process of reaching this state of flow while performing surgery, followed by mezzo-soprano Marina Viotti while singing and prima ballerina Elisa Carrillo Cabrera while dancing.
The first time point when I came across the flow concept was when I was discussing with my friend David Langer from New York, from Lenox Hill. You might know him through the Netflix series. And he pointed out to me that book by this Hungarian philosopher who was talking about, or was writing about, flow. And I learned that it's about learning. If you start as a beginner, you have no idea what you don't know. Then you realize that there are many things where you're not competent yet. Then in the next stage of learning, you are aware that you are becoming confident and competent in the different details, but you still have to think about the right movements and how to master the things. But if you are really close to perfection, and it obviously you'll never be super perfect, but you are close to perfection, then you reach a state where you are suddenly functioning and you are doing the things from your hands, from your mind, and things suddenly happen without being consciousness or aware of it. So it's really automatic. And then things flow out of the body. You do the operation. Time is becoming a relevant issue. You are not nervous anymore. You're not afraid. And things just move along perfectly. And this is really what we understand in surgery when we talk about flow. And this is really the perfect situation. What we are aiming for, and I hope that every surgeon reaches that state on a regular basis, because this gives also the best results.
That's a very interesting comparison, the surgery and the singing through this flow. This state, yes, I have experienced it many times. I think singing is, I always say it's kind of a meditation. It brings you to a place of now, and it's also connecting yourself to your body, your breathing, and you have to be so aware of everything around you on stage, whether it is the conductor giving you indication, the orchestra colors, your colleagues, what's the movements you have to do. For 3 weeks or 1 month, we work like really precisely of which object I have to take on that time, which steps I do on the left. It's like a huge choreography of 3-4 hours that I have to learn, also the text, also the music. And the aim of those 3 weeks of work is that exactly on the day of the show, it's automatic, it's something unconscious that will allow me to have it like printed in my body, and I do it without thinking. And the singing as well, it becomes something very natural, very, yeah, there's a really a flow in this. And I think it's the same for a ballet dancer.
Through the years, we learned to, let's say, even the coordination of how your body moves exactly to certain music, or the choreographers are always telling you what you have to do, so they guide you. But I think there is also this inner way of your body reacting to the movements. And what I find amazing, it's sometimes you dance something and a couple of years you don't perform it. And the day you have to do it again, sometimes you don't, if you try to think of the movement, it doesn't come to your mind. But as soon as the music plays, your body remembers.
Behind this state of flow, there are hours and hours of practice, actually at least 10,000, which is the rule of thumb popularized by Malcolm Gladwell in his book Outliers, The Story of Success. And you already talk about longevity and the quality of longevity. In this train of ideas, what is your take about this rule of thumb?
I think it's generally appropriate, but not completely. I've talked to Anders Ericsson, who was the researcher who identified this 10,000-hour rule. And he said, to become a chess grandmaster, you need 10,000 hours of practice. And they had learned that by studying chess grandmasters, getting their biographies and stuff like that. But he said, these days, with chess programs and with artificial intelligence aids, people can achieve grandmaster status in half that time, and 5,000 hours. So the 10,000 hours is a useful rule of thumb, but it also depends on how those hours are spent. And in fact, the additional gain in skill from the very end isn't all that dramatic. You can probably achieve a very high level in much less than 10,000 hours.
I have also noticed the importance of the physicality in the process of acquiring expertise, as prima ballerina Elisa Carrillo was mentioning in the last excerpt we heard. Have you noticed how different it is to write notes in a notebook, rather to type them in the computer or record them? It is as if the brain and our movements would be in a sort of harmony, working into the entrenching of this experience and thus acquiring certain knowledge. And because life-threatening decisions made under pressure certainly required a fusion of gut feeling with instinct and reflexes, which are physical, I would like to ask you, how strong does insight acquired through the methods we have been talking about become embedded in the brain versus the insight acquired through experience built as a result of hours and hours of practice, which development is accompanied also by sensorial experience?
Right. So I agree with you about the value of writing things down manually. If I've got to write paper, the first thing I do is walk away from my computer. I have a pad of paper and a pen, and I go to a quiet place and I just sort of imagine, what do I want to accomplish with this paper? What's the takeaway message? What kind of examples do I want to use? What stories am I going to include? And I'm just sort of letting my mind wander, as opposed to being in front of my computer and starting to write and then getting frustrated and changing that and threshing through. So that's my own habit, aligns with yours. But you're also asking about motor memory here. That was from the clips that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you're curious about?
Yeah. And, you know, I think like introducing physical movement into the methods you apply, and you actually do this, in my opinion. I think in the shadow box method and in the premortem process, which we're going to talk about later, and when you ask participants to use their imagination and write their ideas down in a piece of paper, you do apply this physicality to the cognitive process. And what I want to ask you is, have these writing down manually, have you noticed a better result as with other methods?
No, I have not. I haven't systematically examined it. But I believe in the importance of the physicality. I can give you an example. There's something called tacit knowledge, which many of the clips that you played refer to these experts who have tacit knowledge, which is knowledge coming from their subconscious, including this motor memory. So let me give you this example. It's a very trivial one. It's almost embarrassingly trivial. A couple of years ago, one of my grandsons, Harold, was his birthday coming up. And his mother asked him, "What would you like for your birthday?" And he said that he wanted me, his grandfather, to make fudge for him, because he had heard that I used to make fudge. And because how can you deny a grandson a wish to make fudge? So I said, "Yes, I will do it." Now, the dirty secret is I hadn't made fudge in over 20 years. And when I made it 20 years ago, I never succeeded. And there was often a step at the end about when you need to pour the fudge, and I would always get it wrong. And I would wait too long, and then when I went to pour it out of the pot, it didn't pour, it was hardening, or if I poured it too soon, it was soup. I never succeeded. And I looked at the recipe, and the recipe said something like, "This requires experience," but it didn't say anything more than that. So I gritted my teeth, and I'm making the fudge, and I've got the ingredients mixed, I've got them cooking, I've got thermometer telling me it's the right temperature. Now I've got to stir it. I'm shaking my head, ready for another failure. And I'm stirring it and stirring it. And all of a sudden, I feel a stiffening in the fudge. And I say, "This is the moment." And I poured it. And for the first time in my life, I actually succeeded. Now, I don't know. That was just motor memory from 20 years. But it came back to me that this was the moment that if I kept stirring it after that, it would be too hard to pour. And now it was just the right consistency. And it was sort of magical. I wasn't prepared for it. And I just recognized it.
Incredible. Dr. Klein, as we heard in the introduction, you have been working and researching for more than 40 years. And what makes me feel most comfortable about the methods you created is the positive energy that they're built on, the way that they're constructed, their purpose, and the looking forward attitude to achieving good results, enabling the creation of positive environments for an effective exchange of input. And I was just mentioning this method before you created, called the premortem method for risk assessment, which received a warm welcoming in the financial management and investment fields. Can you tell us what is this method about, and in which other areas has this method been successfully applied?
Yes, the premortem was a method that I developed in the late 1980s, and I never intended it to be used outside of my company. I noticed that when we would do projects, usually we're very successful, but some of them were less successful than others, and some of them were disappointing. And for the ones that were disappointing, we would do a postmortem. After the project was over, we might not always do it, but we'd say, "What went wrong? And what have we learned from this failure?" And then I thought, why don't we do this exercise at the beginning? Now, a postmortem is an investigation in a medical situation after a patient dies to see why the patient died. And the physician and the medical staff benefit because they learn why the patient died. And the family benefits because they find out why their family member died. And if it was something unusual and noteworthy, somebody on the staff might write an article, so the community might learn. So everybody benefits from a postmortem, except for the patient, because the patient is dead. So I said, let's do this at the beginning, before the project fails. And the way the premortem works is there'll be like a kickoff at the beginning of the project. It might take a few hours or even a day or two. And then at the end of the kickoff meeting where we've gone over the plan and we know who's responsible for what, we reserve maybe 20 minutes, usually not more than a half hour, usually about 20 minutes. And we say we're going to do a premortem. So everybody relax, everybody around the table relax. And imagine that I'm looking into an infallible crystal ball. This crystal ball never lies. And I'm looking at the crystal ball, and it's now 6 months from now, maybe a year from now, and this project has failed. It has crashed. It's been a disaster. We know that. The crystal ball never lies. Now, everybody around the table, you've got 2 minutes to write down why you think the project failed. And everybody writes like crazy for 2 minutes. And then we go around the room and compile what they said. And then we have this amazing list of possible problems. And we've done research. We get many more items by doing the exercise this way than if we had simply said, does anybody see any problems? Does anybody have any objections? Because the harmony of the group, you've just gone over this project. You don't want to think about problems. You don't want to raise them in public. So there's a lot of pressure not to be critical. The premortem changes that mindset. Now you know that the project has failed, and the way you show you're smart is by coming up with good reasons that others might not have considered. And it's a very effective technique. And we've seen it used with firefighters. We've seen it used in the military. Part of their red team exercise. I recently briefed it to the New York Federal Reserve. I'm always astonished at where people are adopting the premortem. Two Nobel Prize winners, Danny Kahneman and Richard Thaler, have both written about and endorsed the method. So I'm astonished that the method has gained so much popularity. I never expected that.
Well, Robert Bella, one of the most important sociologists of our time, authored one of my very, very top favorite books called Religion in Human Evolution. And among many other things, in this book, he explains his theory of play. He says that play is symbolic, that when we play, we're pretending and in a way stepping out of the ordinary course of life into our imaginary, where we feel safe. When we play, we enter into a kind of a bubble, where we can escape from pressures of daily life. And he said that as cultural beings as we are, we take play seriously, and that we're always quite willing to work harder in order to secure time and space for play. So I think that the creation of these safe environments through these kind of methods is a very, very valuable asset. I like also the approach about engaging people with a makeup scenario where you're saying something has gone terribly wrong. And I think here you allow people to slide into another dimension of reality, meaning being able to transport themselves into a space where they can, as I've said, feel safe and comfortable to speak. When you create these scenarios, we're talking about learning, but we're also talking about unlearning. How important is the ability to unlearn, and who is able to let go from learned behaviors and patterns in order to make these adjustments?
I think that's a very important question about unlearning. And it's one of the reasons why as people develop expertise, all of a sudden they hit a plateau where they can do a reasonably good job. And that's as far as they get, whereas potentially they could get even higher. And I think what's happening is they have built a mental model of what's going on, what's the environment. What am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to handle things? And the mental model isn't perfect. And they have some beliefs that aren't quite accurate or are only accurate in some situations, not in others. And they haven't realized how to differentiate that. So that's why they become stuck. And to get people beyond that point, they have to unlearn some of the things that they believed. But they're so successful that they resist the unlearning. And I really like the way you put it, in this play environment, like Shadowbox, or even the pre-mortem, but especially Shadowbox, it's a safe environment for unlearning. It's a safe environment for confronting some of your beliefs. When we build Shadowbox scenarios, we want to have options in there that are reasonable options, but we also have an idea of beliefs that people hold that are getting in their way. And we have these foils that we include to trap them, where they can articulate or rely on these limited beliefs, and then they can see why those beliefs aren't going to get them success in this situation. Part of Shadowbox is learning how the experts see things, but part of Shadowbox is having a chance to express beliefs that you hold that you need to move beyond. And so we try to place these options as traps for them to fall into so they can move beyond their current understanding.
And moving on, in the next excerpt, we will hear neurosurgeon Peter Bajkocy again and orchestral director Karim Hassan talk about leadership, commitment, openness, and human interaction in building a successful team with a common aim in a safe environment.
I think number one, it starts with the selection of the people. They have to be highly motivated and experts in their fields. And we also have scientists there that use the awake patient as a possibility to learn more about the brain. And they also give their input into the whole procedure. Then I think it's very important to have a common aim and a mission. In the OR, when we are treating the patient, obviously everybody's highly motivated of helping the patient, bringing the patient through the surgery. And I think I don't really have to work much on that because everybody understands that they're doing something unique there. And then it needs a commitment of everybody. And this is part of the training. This is part of how they are motivated and how they see the mission. The commitment is really to reach surgery, the surgical procedure at the highest level.
You can actually switch out the word doctor or surgeon for musician in most of what my previous colleague just said. And I think that's true because it's not just to do with the precise subject at hand. So in that case, obviously neurosurgery, or in my case, music. It's not just to do with those things. It's about human interaction as well. And it's about the way that the collaboration can produce the best results possible. And certainly for the case of musicians and for the case of the conductor, my job is to really persuade people and convince them as much as possible that the way that I have studied the music, I believe this is the way that the composer wished this composition to be performed. I once heard that meeting an orchestra for the first time is a bit like going on a blind date. And I think it's so true because on paper, everything can look like it's perfect, that it should be a match made in heaven. It could be a fantastic musician, a fantastic conductor meeting an equally fantastic orchestra. And my goodness, there are many, many stories out there of various musicians and various orchestras who should get along and should be a match made in heaven, but don't, not in the slightest, and simply cannot work together. And then you realize that that is just the beauty of human interaction.
How has been your experience in trying to develop a culture of openness for gaining insight in corporations?
Not as successful as I'd like. I find most organizations believe that it's important to be open, believe that it's important to listen to everybody and to share ideas freely. So they will espouse these values. They may even enshrine them in their corporate value list. It may be part of their policy that they describe. But it's one thing to enunciate a policy, and it's another to put it into practice. And they may say they want it. I find that often they don't know what the implications are. What are the costs of trying to put this into practice? What are they going to have to give up? What are they going to have to open themselves up to? And I think that's one of the ways I like to use Shadowbox, is to help organizations transform policy into practice. Because too often they think that just articulating a policy is sufficient, and it's only the beginning.
That is so true. Like, modern societies think themselves as being open to critique and change, and open, as you said, to new ideas and innovation. But the truth is that most of the people are very resistant to change. What do you do to change a blocking culture, to build a culture of teamwork where goals can be changed? Do you have any tools you can mention? Besides these makeup scenarios, of course, which have been proved to be very successful.
There's a few things you can do. First of all, you can ask for examples where the organization did show itself open to change and try to see what happened in these cases and how the organization can build on these positive examples and what the dynamics were. You can use simulations to prepare people for various contingencies. If they introduce a policy, if they want to be more open to change, what might the costs be and how will they react? And you might help organizations become more realistic rather than just sort of espousing a general policy. They may realize that they're not comfortable being confronted. They don't want to have junior employees raising criticism of what they're doing. And then you can try to see, are there ways for those critiques to be voiced that aren't threatening? Maybe not directly by the junior employees, maybe through some other means, maybe through spokespeople who can take up the views. So I don't think you can expect organizations to all of a sudden become open. And it's inefficient to become open. You don't want to have everybody clamoring and having a voice. So you have to know how to manage it efficiently.
Yeah, you're going to be very happy to hear a neurosurgeon, Professor Baikotsi, talking about how he provides a space for exchanging traumatic experiences with his team and the ability to cope with mistakes.
I learned that talking is a very good way. I talk to myself, I analyze, I talk to my family, my wife, and I like to talk to the team and make them understand and get their input on my mistakes. And I also like to create a philosophy or a concept where everybody should not fear to speak out and describe what they feel and describe their complications so that we learn. And I think complications are acceptable as long as we learn from these complications, as long as we understand where we failed in order to avoid these kind of complications in the future for the next generation of patients that is coming along.
So you were talking about doing the assessments. And so Professor Baikotsi, I mean, he's a great leader and mentor, but there are people in corporations that are calling the shots that are very resilient about changes. What techniques do you use to release the blocking from people on the top of the corporation? I think that's very tough.
Right. So if you're sensing that the organization is so constrained, you need to go back to beginnings. And you need to find out, why have they called you in? What has gone wrong? Why are they struggling? Why are they frustrated? And you need to talk to the people at the top and see what they want to achieve and how badly they want to achieve it. Ideally, people would make changes before it's too late. But very often, they only start to make the changes after they've started a downward spiral. So now they may be motivated because they're gripped by fear as the downward spiral has started.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the motivation, but it may be too late. You want the organization to anticipate that the way they're going might lead them to an unfortunate end. And so you're trying to get them to engage in this kind of anticipation so that you can motivate them. If they're not motivated, then you're not going to accomplish anything.
Dr. Klein, we have been talking a lot about patterns, and this might sound a bit too automized, like taking away the magic from the gut feeling or instinct. But the truth is, you're a big supporter of the human element. And this is because you have been observing people in natural settings during your whole career, whether policemen, firefighters, business people, pilots, people in the military, you name it. I heard in one of your interviews about the IT departments being unable to develop a software that would substitute the expertise of the traders that are in contact with the people all the time. And talking about humans and machines, in your latest book, Snapshots of the Mind, and I love this title, by the way, you debunk the idea that artificial intelligence will soon take over human decision-making, arguing instead that machines can make us smarter and expand our expertise. And you have developed a tool for this. Could you tell us about this tool?
Yes, we developed this as part of a project that we were doing for the United States military, an organization called DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. This was a project called Explainable Artificial Intelligence, XAI. They assembled 11 different international teams who had worked in artificial intelligence to try to make their systems more explainable. The team I was on, led by Robert Hoffman, was cutting across all of the 11 teams to try to understand what does it mean to be explainable. And as we were doing the work, we realized we can come up with a tool that's not a software tool, not an artificial intelligence tool, to help people understand these systems. And it's called AIQ, Artificial Intelligence Quotient. It's about making people smarter, raising their IQ, about the AI systems that they're working with, the specific systems that they're working with. It's a toolkit, and one of the tools is called a cognitive tutorial. So if you were working with an AI system, we would build you a cognitive tutorial about that system that would help you get a better understanding of how the system works. Not a total understanding, because I don't think you're an AI expert, but more of an understanding than you might have. But also, not just how it works, how it fails, what its limitations are, so you can get a sense of where it might struggle, where it might be less reliable. And then, not just where it struggles, but what kind of workarounds you have available to you to overcome the limitations of the system. And then, also how the system might confuse you or other people using you. So this cognitive tutorial is helping to make you smarter about this system so you can use it more effectively as a tool rather than be at its mercy.
To close this interview, I would like to play a last clip. This is Richard Martin, Anthony and Isabel Robicek, professor in classics at Stanford University. We talked in his interview about mythology, the myth of Prometheus, and his stealing of fire to benefit humankind. Let's hear him talk about a new chapter in human history, a new fire called AI.
First of all, I do agree it's a fire that's already started, and living in California, we're constantly aware of wildfire and how once it's started, it's really hard to control. Living and teaching in Silicon Valley, as I do, and commuting from San Francisco, which is the home of AI, I'm very much aware of this. And I think the first fear that people have is that somehow technology driven by AI will just take over and on its own do things like start wars or break down the infrastructure of water and electricity. I worry about that, but I worry even more as a teacher of humanities that AI will take away imagination. It will take away precisely the kind of muses, the space for transcendence that Greek theater and Greek culture cherished so much. Because once you can just say to AI, write me a novel, write me a poem, and it coughs out something that's convincing, but there's no human heart there, it's a new Pandora.
So my last question is, Dr. Klein, so we still need fire, human fire, to keep things rolling?
I think so. The core of all of my work is a respect for expertise and a delight in examples of human expertise. And I think that aligns with the clip that you just played, our ability to imagine, to speculate, and to simulate what might happen and to have insights that are surprising to us. And so wonderful when we reach an insight and to say, I hadn't realized that before. Those are the experiences and those are the capabilities that we try to celebrate. And I've been fortunate to be able to work with people who have expertise and to try to learn from them.
Thank you, Dr. Klein. Your work has significantly advanced our understanding of decision-making and the meaning of intuition in this regard. Your research has been invaluable for improving these decision-making processes, not theoretically, but in real-world environments. And it has been a dream come true, as I've said in the beginning of the interview, to have been able to talk to you, sir. Thank you for your time and a fantastic interview.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you to our listeners, wherever you are, for having allowed us to share time with you. If you found this interview exciting as I did, I do recommend to visit the link www.shadowboxtraining.com, where you will be able to explore more about Dr. Klein's courses, books, and methods. Also, if you want to visit Dr. Klein's masterclass, we have made a QR code called Masterclass in Practical Decision Making available in this episode's description. Thank you, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button.